We have a quorum. We'd like to call a meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. First order of business would be approving of the minutes from March 16th. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes.
Dr. Christensen moves the minutes. March 16th. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
We have minutes approved. All right. Our plan is to get you out of here early today. That's my plan, anyway. First order of business today, we have two guests who will be joining us at the table. Larry Isaac and the Senator David Pierce. And they're from Minnesota Higher Education Compact. We'll get a formal introduction. President Isaac, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. And you will then introduce your guest.
I will.
Thank you very much. Okay. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Larry Isaac. I'm president of the Midwestern Higher Education Compact. Our offices are located here in the Twin Cities. We serve 12 Midwestern states through an interstate compact that Minnesota is a member of. We're very pleased today to have with us Senator David Pierce from Missouri, or Missouri, depending on where you're at in the state. Senator Pierce has been in the legislature, in the House, or the Senate for 14 years. He is chair of the Education Committee, in the Missouri Senate presently. He'll tell you why it's convenient for him to be here this week, but we're just delighted that he is here. He is chair of the commission. Our chair rotates between a legislator and a non-legislator from year to year, and this year Senator Pierce is our chair and has been very active in working with us on a number of initiatives. Senator Pierce.
Thank you, Larry. My name is Senator David Pierce. Mr. Chair.
Proceed. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Thank you. Do have the honor of chairing the Senate Education Committee in Missouri. We're on spring break this week, and so spending my spring break in Minnesota, and then tomorrow we're going to Nebraska to do our state visits on behalf of the Midwestern Higher Education Compact. So some of my colleagues were headed south for spring break, and I headed north, and I'm glad I did. So it's good to be here among friends. Midwestern Higher Education Compact is celebrating its 25th year. There's 12 states in the compact, and there's no state that takes advantage of the programs more than Minnesota. And I've always had a good relationship with the compact. You literally save millions of dollars through cost savings and getting institutions to work together, not only higher institutions, but public schools and private institutions as well. So we want to thank you for your involvement in that, and so that's very important. In addition to the cost savings program, we're also very involved in policy decisions. And as a state representative, or in my case, as a state senator, I think it's always good to be able to get objective information from entities, and the Midwestern Higher Education Compact does provide that. This past year, we worked very hard on the issue of dual credit. And I represent a very rural district in my state. I'm sure some of you do as well. Dual credit's a very tough issue in outstate, because it's very difficult sometimes to find teachers to give our young people a leg up when it comes to getting some college education while they're still in high school. Some of you might have been aware of how the Higher Learning Commission wanted to increase the standards very quickly and would have necessitated some of our students not getting dual credit. Minnesota and Indiana were very, very involved in stopping that implementation as quickly as the Higher Learning Commission. So thank you for your involvement. Also, the Midwestern Higher Education Compact was very involved in it as well. We took that as somewhat of our theme to talk about this past year, dual credit accreditation. And so we were able to get some concessions from the Higher Learning Commission. And just the day before our annual meeting this past fall, they said that they would delay that implementation until the year 2020 for institutions to make that choice if they wanted to. I think that's a big victory for dual credit back home, for a lot of teachers who had been forced to go back to school to get certain credits to teach those courses that they were already teaching, and in my opinion, already doing a very good job. So that's just one example of what the Midwestern Higher Education Compact does. It's an honor for me this year to be the chairman of that. Time is a very precious commodity for us, and we can be involved in a whole host of things. But MEC is the one thing that I've really decided to get involved in because it does so much for our state. Like Minnesota, we've saved millions of dollars over the years, and I think it brings a lot to our students, our teachers, and our parents back home to our home state. So I want to thank Minnesota for your involvement in MEC. The chairman is one of our commissioners, and we have five or six commissioners for each state. And so we appreciate your involvement in MEC as well. Thank you.
We appreciate you being here, and if there are members that have questions, I apologize. The plan yesterday was for both for President Isaac and the Senator Pierce to be at the floor session. But because we were so quick, they didn't quite make it.
But you have quick sessions.
We do. They were in the back. They were in the retiring room as the gavel was being hit. So came close. Any members? President Isaac, I think you mentioned where the headquarters is
located. The headquarters are located here in the Twin Cities. There was a competition where to locate the headquarters 25 years ago. And Minnesota won that competition among the 12 states. Put forward a very good proposal. That was led by former Senator Roger Moe and representatives from the University of Minnesota at the time. And we were actually housed in University of Minnesota space until 3 years ago. They helped incubate the compact during its first formative years, and that was very instrumental in the success of the compact. There are 12 states in the compact. In the Midwest, you have a handout here in front of you. And we've been able to do many things with the help of persons from Minnesota who have helped create different programs, as well as people in all of our states. Our cost savings programs have saved Minnesota $62 million in those years you've been a member in technology and in risk management, property insurance, etc. So we have a very unique niche in this cost savings area, but in addition, we have a number of programs in student access, student success, a couple of those you may have heard about. We have a very new program, we're very optimistic about a program called a multi-state collaborative for military credit, which purpose is to try and achieve improving credit for military education and training for active duty personnel and for veterans. We actually had funding organizations come to us to see if we could take this on a regional level. And it's completely privately funded by $1.1 million in grants from the Lumina Foundation and USA funds to enter into this. So we're very excited about that. So those are some of the kind of things we do. We also have the State Authorization Reciprocity Agreement, which Minnesota was one of the first states to enter into 2 years ago to literally save your institutions millions of dollars in this state and across the country on streamlining what they had to do to receive approval from states for other state citizens to take courses from Minnesota institutions. Well, with online learning, if you have to go to 50 states to get approval, it's pretty expensive. And so a few years ago, a number of entities came together and said, we want the regional higher ed compacts, there are four of these in the country, to implement a reciprocity agreement among states that will completely streamline this thing. In 2 years, 36 states have joined. Now that's pretty fast, and that can that's tremendous when you think about it, what has happened there to come together. And then we do a lot of policy work, as Senator Pierce said. We have a special report that we put out for each state every year. Representative Nornes is familiar with it. It tells you how you're doing on a number of indicators and trending on anything from participation to completion to finance and a whole other number of areas, which shows how Minnesota is doing in a number of areas. So we'd be glad to share that information with you, too, at any other time. So thank you for having us. Mr. Chairman, we really appreciate it. We really appreciate all of the help we get from Minnesota as our home state, you've done a great job in helping really make this compact a great success in the Midwest.
And we didn't talk sports at all.
No.
The senator was very nice not to bring that up. But they will be. You want to know what that is?
Maybe I do.
Maybe you do? Senator, we've got an opening here for you to brag a little bit. So.
Oh, okay. I live pretty close to Kansas City, and so we had a baseball team that won the World Series last year. So.
Not familiar with that.
I'm not familiar with that. I'll talk to you offline. Missouri, yeah.
All right.
It's been 30 years since we'd won anything, so
that's
a lot of pent-up enthusiasm there.
Members, have any questions? Otherwise, we do appreciate you coming to visit Minnesota and coming to our committee. I'm not sure when you leave, but there's snow on the way, so I think timing was good for you, probably.
Yeah.
So, again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
We have a couple of bills today, and we're going to begin with Representative Green, Steve Green, House File 2590. I will move House File 2590, and I believe there is an amendment that you have. It's an oral amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to amend House File 2590. I would like on page 1 to delete lines 7 to 9, and also on page 1 delete line 10 with the head note subdivision 2, no net gain approval.
Okay. Everyone get that?
Mr. Chair, could you
do we need to repeat it? You want to repeat it?
Yes, thank you.
You want to repeat the
I can try. House File 2590 will be amended on page 1 to delete lines 7 to 9, and on line 10, delete the head note, subdivision 2, no net gain and county approval.
Essentially, it's removing Minskew from the bill.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it's great that we're removing those. I'm glad to see that. And I'm wondering if the same thing's going to be done to all of these, if maybe the committee just wants to forward them without recommendations, seeing as how there will be no higher ed components any longer.
That's basically, I think, our plan.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion on the oral amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted, and since Minskew is out of the bill, we do not no longer have any jurisdiction, so we will then forward that to the State Government Finance Committee. All right. We want to vote on this. Okay. Do you get the vote?
Yes,
all those
Mr.
in favor.
Chair. Could I request that we recommend moving it to that committee without recommendation, since we're not going to hear the bill?
I think that's fair.
Okay.
All right. Okay, all those in favor of the moving 2590, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Louder, please.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay. All right. Now we'll do 25. Thank you very much for Representative Green, or Representative Green. House File 2591 is the next bill up today. Very similar action necessary, and you want to offer the amendment to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will. The amendment is identical amendment. On page 1, delete lines 7 to 9, and on page 1, delete line 10, delete the head note, subdivision 2, approval required.
Okay, I'll offer the amendment to House File 2591. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, that amendment is adopted. And now we will then move House File 2591 to the State Government Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Green. We have one more bill here dealing with the Office of Higher Education. Happens to be mine. Is there a representative here today from...
Mm-hmm.
If it's all right for the committee, I'm just going to stay here and offer my House File 3237, which has some technical and policy changes brought to us by the Office of Higher Education. And we'll be just laying this over after the presentations. You want to proceed and introduce yourself and then kind of walk through the bill, please.
Yep. I'm Nikki Oliver, Legislative Liaison for the Office of Higher Education.
And Mr. Chair, I'm Meredith Burgess, Manager of Financial Aid Research for the Office of Higher Education.
So I'll just go through the policy bill section by section. The first section is management of programs. This is, as you know, our office was assigned several programs, new programs, last session, and either they weren't funded or weren't adequately funded for administration. So this is safety net language. If the legislator does not appropriate or designate any admin funds, the office may retain up to 5% for new programs established after January 1 of 2016. Section 2 is receipt of donations, money, and grants. Working with MMB, we know we have limited authority to accept outside funds, especially from nonprofits, private entities such as Lumina and Gates Foundation. And with this language, it would make it explicit our ability to accept and retain until spent such funds. That section. Section 3 deals with the teacher shortage loan forgiveness program that was assigned to our office last session. There's just clarification language. On lines 2.6 through 2.9, we are striking that language because later in line 2.24, we're clarifying that the recipients could only receive the grants up to 5 years. As it currently reads, it sounds like they can receive the grant 6 years. So we're clarifying that. Lines 2.1 through 2.3 is to clarify, and we also spoke with the author on these items as well, is to clarify that to be eligible, you need to be teaching in a shortage subject area or in a shortage geographical area. As the language currently reads, it sounds like you need to be in both, and that was not the intent of the author. The final edit to this program is on line 2.30, and that is to clarify the receipt that a participant, the time in which a participant has paid their loan with the funds given. Currently reads that they have 60 days upon receipt. We have no way of knowing when someone receives the funds, but we can verify when the money went out. So we're changing that language to say 60 days within disbursement date. So those are the items there. The final change is to the reporting requirements for the two-year occupational scholarship program. It is a pilot program that ends in 2019, so we just want the report dates to reflect that it's a pilot. So that is all for the policy bill.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Oh, Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question related to the Office of Higher Ed being able to receive donations, grants, bequests. I'm just curious, is this typical of other state agencies? Have there been instances where donations have been made? What sorts of donations are these?
Other state agencies actually have language. We don't have the language, so that's why we're doing it now. We go back and forth with MMB on ways to accept these funds, and they constantly say we need to put it in statute.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what sorts of donations are these, I guess? Just
Mr. Chair and Representative Lean, currently we are the recipient of two grants. One is from the Lumina Foundation to support gathering stakeholders to support Minnesota's new educational attainment goal. That grant came with approximately, what, $25,000, Nikki? $50,000? $50,000 to support stakeholder involvement. However, MMB is questioning our ability to actually accept those funds, even though we were awarded them. Secondly, we also did receive some funds from the Gates Foundation in support of a research study trying to ascertain why Minnesota students borrow so much in terms of paying for higher education and if there are policies or programs the state can implement to reduce our borrowing levels.
Okay. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that clarification.
Representative Norton.
I don't have a question for the testifiers, but just in relation to this this bill, and I just for the record, we talked prior to the committee, we had some members that had amendments today and were very disappointed that the one bill was pulled because we think it was a bill we would have all liked to vote on. But, you know, members in the minority don't often get their bills heard, and so amendments were drafted as, you know, as the what happens around here. And they're really important policy. You know, the amendments are very important policy changes for some members on this aisle, and I suspect we'll have support from the other aisle as well. And I just wanted for the record to say that we really appreciate we're not going to offer those amendments to your bill here, the OHE bill, even though we had them drafted for that. But we're just going to say thank you for the opportunity to hear bills, these bills and perhaps some others, because I know there's a lot of bills about student loans and things that the OHE and others work on in the coming week. So just wanted to thank you for that, and we apologize, I think, for some confusion here, because I think we all want great turnouts, great results from our students. We don't want them to be saddled with death, and we don't want them to have that either, debt. And there's lots of great ideas out there, and so we appreciate that you're going to hear those in the coming weeks. Thank you.
Thank you. So House File 32. Oh, Representative Pugh, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I just want a clarification on the Gates Foundation. I was surprised to hear you say that. I didn't even give consideration that there would be grants coming in directly from outside sources to the agency. And I'm wondering if you can recall specifically if what the amount was from the Gates Foundation, and then wondering if there's any previous history of other entities, was it Lumina, as well as Gates, in previous bienniums?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the Gates Foundation money totals only $37,000. Typically for a research study, we don't necessarily charge time for that, but it is to cover the IT costs. Minute charges us to pull data for the study, and so it is to recoup those costs that Minute's charging us. That's pretty much the only resources we accept for that. There is additional funds in the Gates Foundation grant that actually go to pay an external researcher to assist us with the project, and that's where the majority of funds actually go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In terms of prior biennia, it actually rarely happens. So I just think it's kind of funny that this year we got two small grants. Typically, those monies will go directly to Minsky or the U if they're supporting institutional efforts, not to the Office of Higher Education.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Otherwise, House File 3237 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. I understand that Commissioner Hogan Miller is not feeling well today.
No.
Are you here to fill in on the report, or do we do that a different day?
On the GovRec.
You're prepared to do that now?
Yes, I am.
All right. Then let's go ahead.
Chair Nordness and committee, I understand that you all will also be hearing from Minsky and the U tomorrow, so I won't go into detail on their items. I will go over the high-level stuff. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith have proposed significant new initiatives to expand educational opportunities for all Minnesotans and eliminate disparities for Minnesotans of color. Minnesota is doing a pretty good job overall getting students into college. 67% of Minnesota's 2014 high school grads went on to college the following fall. However, there are lower participation rates for first-generation and low-income students who are disproportionately students of color.
These students not only enroll in college at lower rates, they are also more likely to drop out, leaving them with the burden of student debt without the certificate or degree needed to reap the economic opportunities a post-secondary education can provide. In 2015, you all passed and the governor signed into law a statewide attainment goal for 70% or more of Minnesota residents aged 25 to 44 to hold a post-secondary degree or certificate by 2025. There are challenges meeting this goal. Six-year graduation rates at four-year institutions are rising, but a 12% gap exists between whites and students of color. This gap has increased by 3% since 2008. In 2014, graduation rates for students of color at state colleges were more than 10% lower than their white peers. Minnesota ranks 34th nationally in retention at two-year institutions. I have more demographics, but I'll go into the actual recs. The governor's supplemental budget appropriates $20 million for equity and opportunity grants. These resources will be managed by the Office of Higher Education in collaboration with colleges, universities, public and non-public, and their appropriate nonprofit partners to support their efforts to narrow existing gaps in post-secondary attainment. The grants will fund, in the form of a matching grant, research-based effective efforts being used to increase retention and completion rates for undertrained and underserved students. Many of these strategies are already being employed successfully within Minnesota by our institutions, public and non-public, and in collaboration with nonprofits working with communities of color and first-generation students. These grants are meant to scale up and institutionalize a successful and sustainable retention completion culture in Minnesota. The governor's supplemental also provides $21 million in continuing funds to MinSCU for operating support and protecting affordability. The University of Minnesota portion of the RECs is $10.5 million for healthcare restoration, that's continuing, and $19 million for cybersecurity, which is one-time spending. The U of M's request also includes $5.75 million in fiscal year 16-17 and $6.5 million fiscal year 18-19 for Healthy Minnesotan. There's $100 million of this is targeted that is key to hit as a fundamental building block for next session. This will take an intentional, targeted, several-year commitment to change our institutional culture or support its evolution to where we need to be to meet our workforce needs. The equity and opportunity grants proposed by Governor Dayton are aimed at dramatically narrowing the racial and first-generation attainment gaps in Minnesota post-secondary education. These grants, combined with the $21 million base funding increase for the MinSCU system, will support the creation of a culture of completion across Minnesota post-secondary education, particularly at our two-year campuses. So. I'll stand for any questions.
Oh, thank you. The governor did not add any money to the state grant program. He was pretty generous in places, but not there.
Yeah. Chair Nornes, the governor made a significant investment into the state grant last session, and with this being a non-budget year, has chosen to focus on areas where there could be investments made to equity and opportunity in the form of one-time spending.
All right. Members have any questions? Representative Lean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And based on some of the legislation recently passed, I understand the office can put more funding from surplus dollars in the state grant program into the tuition caps or into the LME.
Actually, Chair Nornes, Representative Meredith Fergus is actually here to present on the state grant projections, and yes, the commissioner does have the authority to put any spending balance on either LME or tuition and fee maximums.
Ms. Fergus.
Mr. Chair and members, you were distributed a handout that talks about the Minnesota State Grant recent projections from February. If you look at page one, it gives you the location of our latest report on our website. But it also notes that state grant projections are produced twice a year, November 1st.
I interrupt for a minute. I only got page two.
Oh, it's
It's two-sided.
And then page four.
Yeah, two and four.
Is it labeled wrong?
It's, sorry, one, two, three, four, sorry.
They're slides.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
My apologies.
We should have caught on to that. But, you know, it's 3:30, 3:20.
Chair Norris, me and Meredith have been in committee since 8 o'clock this morning and with little food, so we apologize.
All right. Page two would have been a little more. We could have figured that out, so.
Sorry, okay. Mr. Chair. The top
Go ahead.
Of page
Go ahead.
Two. The projections are released on November 1st and February 15th of each year. What we do is we first contact institutions and gather data from them on what their projected enrollment changes are for fall term as well as the full year. And then we also ask them what their potential tuition fee increases are. We also look at what the federal government is doing in terms of Pell Grant or the federal needs analysis, which calculates how much students will get in terms of a Pell Grant. And then we pull in data from Minnesota Revenue on wages of Minnesota tax filers so we can monitor how Minnesota's economy is changing. What you have on the bottom of page two is the chart that we released on February 15th of this year. It shows that under current projections, we currently have a spending balance of just over $12 million within the state grant program. The largest drivers in spending declines, the projection at the end of last session was about $3 million. We increased to $12 million by February, largely because enrollment declined at rates higher than anticipated by our institutions. Also, the federal Pell Grant was actually increased and funded by Congress as of January, and so that actually brought in some $4 to $6 million. The actual dollar amounts are on the top of page four. You can see we track what is called the technical changes in our spending estimates, just so we're being transparent. Enrollment estimates between the end of session in November resulted in $6.5 million of money being freed up, and the Pell Grant changes, which is in the bottom section of that top chart, resulted in a $2 million. There's an error in my change column. Approximately a $2 million decline in estimated spending. The one thing I want to do highlight is the chart that's on the bottom of page four. Currently, we are projecting that by the end of this biennium, Minnesota will have experienced six straight years of enrollment declines. And if you look at the chart, this is essentially unprecedented since 1978. So it really calls into perspective what our institutions have been facing over the most recent 5 to 6 years in terms of the fact that fewer students are enrolling, and therefore, given the other fiscal impacts of state budgeting, that it really has been a complex situation for them. Mr. Chair, I would add that as of the end of February, the commissioner did notify the chairs of both the House and Senate Higher Education Committee of his intent to spend down the $12 million by increasing the state grant living and miscellaneous expense allowance. That would increase state grant awards. It would increase the living and miscellaneous expense allowance by $420, which would essentially result in a $210 increase to next year's state grant awards for full-time students.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. Could you pointed out the 6 years of decrease, and we've been hearing this throughout all of our colleges and universities, and it's a little understandable to me with some of our Minscu institutions. When the job market's good, people can work, and maybe they're working rather than going to school. Do you have an explanation other than perhaps demographics, which we haven't really talked a lot about the demographic shifts. Is this explained through demographics? Is there some other thing that you can point to help us understand?
Ms. Ferguson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it is largely a function of the economy. The two-year institutions are such a sizable portion of Minnesota students that anything that affects them dramatically will affect the overall state trend line. So this trend is largely those two-year students choosing to work instead of enroll. Among our four-year colleges, especially those that enroll more traditional students, such as the University of Minnesota and our private colleges, what we're actually seeing is enrollment stabilize. They've been showing declines of negative 0.1%, negative 0.2%, but pretty much stable across the trend for the last 2 years. However, we do expect the number of Minnesota high school graduates to begin to decline starting in fiscal year 18, so I don't know that they'll be able to maintain that stability over the long term. But yeah, it is largely the two-year workforce.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Norton.
You know, one of the things that's been disappointing to me in my 10 years at the legislature is the drop in funding and the shift from, you know, being the state burden paying for higher ed to being the student burden primarily, and loans and all that for students. How do you say you've struggled. I absolutely can understand why, you know, folks would be struggling with all this, but, what you know, do you have a suggestion for, you know, how we can look at this? I won't be here, but others will. How do you start accounting for those demographic changes as well as the impact, and how can we expect your office as well as the colleges themselves to adjust their budgets, because it's going to be very difficult.
Who has the answer?
Yeah. It's a good question.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure anyone quite has the answer. I will tell you, there has been a bright spot in Minnesota. If you look about, if you look at the data we have on how much our lowest income students are paying for college, with the increases to state grant, the increases to Pell Grant, and the tuition freezes that have been enacted, our lowest income students are paying the same for college as they did 5 and 6 years ago. So we actually have managed to succeed at least keeping the price of college somewhat stable for those students. So as their economy recovers, there is a glimmer of hope that if we maintain stability, we will be able to almost lower the burden of college costs for them. However, as you mentioned, it is a complex interaction of tuition policies, financial aid investments, and the resources students and families have. So I don't have the answer.
I think that is very complicated, and I think it's going to increase the competition among institutions. I mean, that's probably a good thing, because everybody's going to have to really perform at their peak and deliver, you know, so the value is there. But it's going to be difficult. Representative Lean, did you have? I think I've got Barrett in front of you. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, the question I have is somewhat related to Representative Norton as it relates to future projections and what higher ed will do. A couple months ago, in response to the issue regarding whether we should, whether the U of M should raise tuition for non-residents, there's an editorial in a local paper that said that would be a really bad thing to do because we rely on non-residents to come in to fulfill and fill our job market, which by the year 2023 or so, we're going to have a lack of workers. So it caused me to look into the issue, and I looked at a report from Deed that looked at the labor market in 2023, and we are projected to have a 80,000 worker shortage, but the shortage was in two areas mostly, and that almost primarily, and that would be high school educated and non-high school educated. So a lot of the shortages were in the service industries related to healthcare, PCAs, and others, in which there was a need for technical knowledge, not necessarily a four-year degree. So that's a long introduction to my question as to whether you in the OHE work with Deed to understand long-term projections. I'm thinking specifically of the six-year trend of fewer people going to college. Are they just aware that a lot of the jobs that are going to be needed in which there's a shortage in the future don't require a four-year degree? And if that's true, what has higher ed done to downsize or right-size their organization to account for that, if you know?
That's, Mr. We have a lot
Chair.
Of time, so take time to answer the question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett, we do work with Deed in understanding how the supply of college-educated workers actually meets our workforce demand. And actually, there's a number of ways we do that. For example, MNSCU actually gets data from Deed and can analyze the extent to which their programs are serving workforce needs in given areas. So there is a data exchange component that MNSCU does participate in. We're expanding that data exchange component to actually be all colleges through the statewide longitudinal data system project so that all colleges can begin to use actual employment data to understand their programs better. In terms of the fact that the shortage of workers will be in those high school or below educated workforce, we see those numbers as well. I think the one thing I would say about those numbers is many of us actually worked in those jobs jobs in entry-level fields before going to college, and most of those jobs do not pay sustainable family wages. And so we need to be clear on whether we're expecting those positions to be short-term positions or long-term career opportunities for students. And I think having a workforce in which the ability is to have them start an entry wage work and then get education and training and move on is actually something we need to take into consideration. That said, we also we're very aware that we actually may need more technical workers, and so I do think emphasizing more on the vocational, technical, and career education aspects of Minnesota's system are important. When we talk college at the Office of Higher Education, we're talking any form of post-secondary education and training, be it a 5-credit certified nursing assistant program all the way up to a PhD, provided that it is leading to a career in which you will have sustainable employment at a wage where you can support a family in Minnesota.
Representative Baird, quick follow-up to that. As it relates to the slide in which there's 6 years of a pattern of behavior by people coming to college or not coming to college, do you think that their understanding of the job market in the future is would cause that slide to continue? I mean, it's bad from higher ed, but granted, we want everyone to have a highly successful job which pays a goodly amount of money, but similar studies say there's a glut of college educated, so a lot of those folks aren't getting the jobs they want, unfortunately. We want all of them to, but I think in cases they're not. Will this trend continue because of that balance between the investment you're putting in the college college education and the return you would be expected to get over your lifetime?
Mr. Sharon, Representative Baird, I don't expect the enrollment declines to continue long term. I do think they will begin to stabilize as we recover. I don't think we're doing enough to inform prospective students about what their labor market outcomes are likely to be. So the one thing we did do is DEED and the Office of Higher Education 2 weeks ago released a new version of the Graduate Employment Outcomes Tool, which is on DEED's website, which allows students, parents, or prospective students, workers, to go in and actually look at the outcomes for individuals of given programs at a specific college. So if you wanted to know what a person earning a welding certificate from a vocational college in your area was making, you could look it up for the last 5 years of graduates from that program. And so that to that extent, we think information like that is useful to our students. But do I think everybody's going to rush to the DEED website to look it up either? No. So we have to figure out ways of packaging it where it's actually consumer-friendly. So possibly building it into career and college and career interest inventories in high school, using it in workforce centers better, those kinds of things.
Just a quick follow-up, Representative Baird. Thank you for that. Could you send that to us? You probably already have, and I probably haven't just realized how important it is. That's a great tool that we should be communicating to the people that we represent so that they can make good decisions on what majors they might want to pursue based on their interest and passion and also their ability to find a job in that particular market. So if you could send that to us, that'd be great. Thank you.
Still have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back again to some of the discretion the Office of Higher Ed has to put surplus money into tuition cap or the LME area, what sort of qualifications or how do you prioritize which of those areas you focus on if, you know, you were not to have enough resources to supplement both of them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee,
Fergus.
Typically the Office of Higher Education will always prioritize living and miscellaneous expenses. However, I think the kind of perspective we also hold is that we spent 10 years trying to get the tuition fee maximum to cover the University of Minnesota's tuition. And it was a fight that we felt, you know, if you're going to offer grants to public college students, we should treat the University of Minnesota equally. And so we wanted to make sure we had a little bit of authority to do that. But again, our priority is always going to be living in miscellaneous expenses.
All right. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much. And wish the commissioner good health. We didn't frighten him away or anything, did we?
No.
Okay.
No. If he could have been here, he would have been here.
I'm sure he would. Tell him to stop by when he has time and when he's feeling better.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Anything else the members want to talk about? Because we have time. But I promise you we would get out early, and so right now I adjourn the meeting.